It was another 20 minutes before the wind wagon tied up to one of the wharves. The craft came out of the north, its sails white squares against a dark plain draining of color. The last light had faded by the time the large ship had tacked close to the low bluff, folded its mainsails, and rolled to a stop. The consul was impressed. The thing was wooden, handcrafted, and huge, curved in the pregnant lines of some sea-going galleon out of old Earth's ancient history. The single gigantic wheel, set in the center of the curving hull, normally would have been invisible in the 2-meter-tall grass. But the consul caught a glimpse of the underside as he carried luggage onto the wharf. From the ground it would be 6 or 7 meters to the railing, and more than 5 times that height to the tip of the mainmast. From where he stood, panting from exertion, the consul could hear the snap of pennants far above and a steady, almost subsonic hum that would be coming from either the ship's interior flywheel or its massive gyroscopes. A gangplank extruded from the upper hull and lowered itself to the wharf. Father Hoyt and Braun Lamia had to step back quickly or be crushed. The wind wagon was less well lighted than the Benares. Illumination appeared to consist of several lanterns hanging from spars. No crew had been visible during the approach of the ship, and no one came into view now.
"Hello,"
called the consul from the base of the gangplank. No one answered.
"Wait here a minute, please,"
said Kassad, and mounted the long ramp in 5 strides. The others watched while Kassad paused at the top, touched his belt where the small death wand was tucked, and then disappeared amidships. Several minutes later, a light flared through broad windows at the stern, casting trapezoids of yellow on the grass below.
"Come up,"
called Kassad from the head of the ramp.
"It's empty."
The group struggled with their luggage, making several trips. The consul helped Het Mastin with the heavy Mobius trunk, and through his fingertips he could feel a faint but intense vibration.
"So where the fuck is the crew?"
asked Martin Silenus when they were assembled on the foredeck. They had taken their single-file tour through the narrow corridors and cabins, down stairways more ladder than stairs, and through cabins not much bigger than the built-in bunks they contained. Only the rearmost cabin, the captain's cabin, if that is what it was, approached the size and comfort of standard accommodations on the Benares.
"It's obviously automated,"
said Kassad. The force officer pointed to halyards which disappeared into slots in the deck, manipulators all but invisible among the rigging and spars, and the subtle hint of gears halfway up the lateen-rigged rear mast.
"I didn't see a control center, not so much as a disky or C-spot nexus."
She slipped her comm log from a breast pocket and tried to interface on standard data, comm, and biomed frequencies. There was no response from the ship.
"The ships used to be crewed,"
said the consul.
"Temple initiates used to accompany the pilgrims to the mountains."
"Well, they're not here now," said Hoyt. "But I guess we can assume that someone is still alive at the tram station or Keep Kronos. They sent the wagon for us."
"Or everyone's dead and the wind wagon is running on an automatic schedule."
She looked over her shoulder as rigging and canvas creaked in a sudden gust of wind.
"Damn, it's weird to be cut off from everybody and everything like this. It's like being blind and deaf. I don't know how colonials stand it."
Martin Silenus approached the group and sat on the railing. He drank from a long green bottle and said,
"Where's the poet? Show him. Show him, muses mine, that I may know him. 'Tis the man who with a man is an equal, be he king or poorest of the beggar class, or any other wondrous thing a man may be twixt ape and Plato. 'Tis the man who with a bird, wren, or eagle finds his way to all its instincts. He hath heard the lion's roaring, and can tell what his horny throat expresseth. And to him the tiger's yell comes articulate, and presseth on his ear like mother tongue."
Where did you get that wine bottle?
Asked Kassad. Martin Silenus smiled. His eyes were small and bright in the lantern glow.
The galley's fully stocked. And there's a bar. I declare it open.
We should fix some dinner,
said the consul. Although all he wanted at the moment was some wine, it had been more than 10 hours since they had last eaten. There came a clank and whir, and all six of them moved to the starboard rail. The gangplank had drawn itself in. They whirled again as canvas unfurled, lines grew taut, and somewhere a flywheel hummed into the ultrasonic. Sails filled, the deck tilted slightly, and the wind wagon moved away from the wharf and into the darkness. The only sounds were the flap and creak of the ship, the distant rumble of the wheel, and the rasp of grass on the hull bottom. The six of them watched as the shadow of the bluff fell behind, the unlighted beacon pyre receding as a faint gleam of starlight on pale wood. And then there were only the sky and night and swaying circles of lantern light.
I'll go below,
said the consul,
and see if I can get a meal together.